Today on the 21st Show, retired American diplomat Eric Whitaker. Born, raised, and educated in Illinois, he would join the Peace Corps and eventually the U.S. Foreign Service. His postings included South Korea, Sudan, Baghdad, and the region of Western Africa known as the Sahel, where he was U.S. Ambassador to Niger. We'll talk about his background, what's happening in Africa today, and the future of American foreign policy. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Bloomington Normal, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today we're spending the hour with the retired American diplomat Eric Whitaker. Born and raised in DeKalb and North Aurora, Illinois, he earned 2 degrees at the U of I and then joined the Peace Corps. Eventually, he would join the Foreign Service after postings in South Korea, Sudan, Iraq, and elsewhere. In 2017, he was nominated to be the U.S. Ambassador to Niger, a large landlocked country in Western Africa. In fact, or I should say, Niger is an interesting country. It's a large country, arid landscape. How large, you might be wondering? Well, if you superimpose Niger over a map of America, it covers all or most of Illinois, Iowa, Missouri, Arkansas, Kansas, and Oklahoma, also parts of Texas and New Mexico. Some other facts about Niger. These are taken from the BBC's country page, which is dated to 2023. The population is 24.4 million. Life expectancy was 60 years for men, 62 for women. It's landlocked, but it has significant mineral wealth, including gold and uranium. And since it won independence from France in 1960, it's gone back and forth between military and democratic rule. In fact, the first peaceful transfer of power happened while Whitaker was ambassador in 2021, though that came after 3 days of protests and an attempted coup. President Mohamed Barzoum took office but was deposed in another military coup 2 years later. Eric Whitaker retired from the State Department in 2021, though he's been called back into government service at least 2 times since then. He joins us now to talk about his life and work and American foreign policy. He's on campus this week, also speaking with students and others at the Center for Africa Studies. Eric Whitaker, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on The 21st Show.
Oh, Brian, delighted. Thank you for allowing me to talk with you today. Appreciate the opportunity.
And listeners, you can join us throughout the hour, 800-222-9455, if you have questions about America's Foreign Service, about Africa. This is the time, 800-222-9455. All right, let's start with your background. You were born and raised in DeKalb. Your family moves to North Aurora. You graduate from high school there. What was your understanding of the wider world when you were a child?
The first 11 years of my life were in DeKalb, as you noted, growing up on the NIU campus, Northern Illinois University, while my mother was getting her master's degree. So having that opportunity, I started in an international context, international students, scholars, fellows from abroad. So that perhaps started curiosity. We moved to North Aurora, where I lived another 11 years, 35 miles due west of Chicago. So you had the farms and fields, I detasseled corn, village, suburbs. You could be anywhere in the city within an hour, which is where Grandma lived. So you had the best of all worlds. Champaign-Urbana, what a phenomenal experience. Bachelor's in biology and a master's in community health education. And again, such a large number of international students. And this played a role in my graduate school, wherein international students said, you're not married, you don't have a car payment, you don't have a mortgage. Now is the perfect time to join the Peace Corps. So I became interested and decided, yes, I would join. I went up to Chicago and interviewed, and they said, well, you have a master's in community health. Let's put you into a community health program. So they offered me several postings. I chose the Philippines because it seemed to be the polar opposite of Chicagoland. So I lived in a bamboo hut on the edge of the ocean. I taught in a rural high school in slow, simple English using books I got from Asia Foundation. And community sanitation, like blind drainage sinks, water-sealed toilets, insect and rodent control, family planning, nutrition, a wide variety of things that directly pertain to my education.
Let me stop you there because I was curious about this. A couple things I want to ask you about that time in your life. One is, what is your first impression of the Philippines when you arrive on station, you see where you're going to be living? I mean, you'd been in DeKalb, Aurora, Champaign-Urbana. I'm guessing not exactly roughing it in those locales. What is your first impression of life in the Philippines? Were you prepared for that?
I was surprised in that it's a cultural crossroads. 333 years of cross and sword, the Spanish colonial presence, Magellan. Trade with China over the millennia. Chinese occupation during World War II. MacArthur leaving Corregidor. MacArthur returning to Leyte, and his statue is still in the surf. I shall return, and they remember that vividly. And the old-timers remember Lucky Strike cigarettes and Baby with candy bars. And everywhere you go, Hey Joe, like G.I. Joe. So it was a country that was welcoming for Americans. It was the largest Peace Corps program in the world. So we had a strong footing. We were welcome in the Philippines. What I did was appreciated. It was a marvelous experience. And when you're in Manila, the Big Mango, they allowed you to take lunch at the American Embassy, which is right on Manila Bay. That's up on the 8th floor. And you got to talk to embassy stiffs. People who think they know the Philippines were like, yeah, right, whatever. But you chat them up and you find out, wait a minute, you represent the United States overseas and you get paid to do it. What's the catch? That's where the seed was planted. I didn't grow up knowing diplomats. Very few people probably do. They're usually overseas, which is their assignment. So I started thinking about the Foreign Service. Well, my wife and I went to the University of Pittsburgh and took Master of Public Administration. We worked in local government in California for 6 years, and that's where both of our kids were born. We really believed in City Hall, local government, grassroots. But the itch was there for about the State Department. Took the test at Cal State University in Sacramento, passed it, and then took the oral exam in the federal building in San Francisco. It's a very lengthy process. It takes about 2 years to get in, and then you're finally placed on a list. So way back then, we drove across the country, nearly 3,000 miles, with kids in tow, to join the State Department. And it worked out well, and both of us made careers in the Foreign Service, and it worked out very well for us. And the majority of our postings by choice were in Africa. And I'm proud to say to this day, our children grew up in Africa.
And I want to come back to that. Before we move on from your early life, I have to ask, I read you were in the Marching Illini and a number of other universities. We have that. I was also involved in the university bands at U of I. What was your instrument?
I played clarinet. I was in Marching Illini 6 years, 5 years
wow.
as a marcher, and 1 year as a graduate assistant.
Oh, nice.
Helping on the sidelines and all the choreography and conducting on the sidelines because line of sight with the head conductor, a lot of things. And, of course, you have a band trip each year to another Big Ten school. Every year we'd go up to a Bears game in Soldier Field. A lot of fun. Also in concert band. Also, I was president of the basketball band. Free seats, and you play at the game, and it's great competition, of course. I conducted the hockey band. You bring an instrument, you get in free. Pretty good deal. So we had a lot of fun with band. But I was in InterVarsity, Christian Fellowship. I was in Alpha Phi Omega, Service Fraternity. I very much enjoyed campus life and was busy with any number of activities all over the campus. Volunteer Illini projects, doing the blood drives each year. It was what a rich experience with students from every state and nearly every country across the globe. Phenomenal university, and I'm glad to see how university continues to burnish its reputation over the years. I come back each and every autumn. I have a scholarship at the Center for African Studies. I talk to African faculty, African students, my scholarship students. I talk about Peace Corps. I talk about the Foreign Service. I'm even going to the football game on Saturday. I come back every year. I'm hooked on it. I really feel I have roots here that last to this day.
All right, so you're in, and I got to say, your describing of your undergrad experience puts me in mind of this quote I once read from John McCain, who said, "The more you do, the more you do." Something about busyness feeding on itself. Let me ask you about your first assignment. I understand it's Seoul, South Korea. You don't know, right? There's actually a ceremony where they present you with a flag of the country to which you're going. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we had a course is called A100. That's our orientation. And it's 9 weeks long. and you put in your interests in which post on the list you might want to serve in. And the first two assignments are directed. In other words, the department chooses where to send you to maximize your opportunity to get tenured. So it's a big post, small post, embassy, consulate, developed country, developing country. Well, I bid high on Seoul because I frankly wanted to go back to Asia. I'd been in the Philippines. Korea was, this is 1990 we're talking about. It's quite some time ago. I mean, I could have gone to Korea in the Peace Corps in 1980. Things have changed that much. So I saw a dynamic society with heavy sociocultural change and evolution going on. And I was quite curious about this. So I was the only one in my class that bid high on Seoul, Korea. And three of us went, one from the Foreign Commercial Service and two of us from State Department. I got the language designated position because I already had an Asian language and because of my score on the Modern Language Aptitude Test, the MLAT. So I was 8 months in Korean, went to post and started interviewing immigrant visas in Korean. But I could go around town, take a taxi, subway, buses, and bargain in the markets and order in restaurants because I had enough Korean to do that. So I actually got off language probation in Korean. A wonderful posting. I very much enjoyed it. I was able as a vice consul to do immigrant visa, non-immigrant visas, fraud section, and American citizen services, which is passports, notarials, jail visits, prison visits, which are a different thing. Prison visit is when you go to see someone quarterly who's there for the long term, and you bring them old magazines, vitamins, and letters from mom. And you just try to make sure that they're okay and that the embassy remains interested in their case. A phenomenal posting. And then suddenly there was a breakthrough, and we both had the opportunity to go to Khartoum, Sudan. My wife had been posted in Washington, and the kids were with her the first year. The second year, they came and joined me in Seoul, Korea. So we ended up together in Africa and got hooked on the continent, and the Bureau of African Affairs was very eager to keep us, and it worked out for everyone's interest.
Maybe this is a good time to ask about, because you mentioned you already had Philippine language. I believe that was Visayan, if
yes.
I'm saying that correctly.
Yes.
And Korean. I've read you also speak Portuguese, Spanish, and French. How does one learn languages? Is the Foreign Service just for people with that aptitude, the polyglot people? Or is this something that can be learned? What advice do you have about that?
Oh, not at all. We have the Foreign Service Institute, which is the National Foreign Affairs Training Center, NAFATSE, and that's in Arlington, Virginia. It's on Highway 50, just across from Washington, just maybe 10 minutes outside. It's like a community college. Buildings, we train leadership and management, regional studies, management, all manner of technology, but up to 82 languages. So I was there for 8 months learning Korean. Then when you go to post, posts have what's called language at post, and you go to tutorials. It might be a small group, it might be one-on-one, and you do that during your posting because it helps you learn the language. Well, over the years, I served in five Francophone countries, so I have a month of French here, month of French there, working with the tutor, especially to prep for speeches or to scan newspaper headlines to be sure I really got the gist of articles. So French along the way. And when I went out to be chief of mission, during the waiting period between when you're nominated and when you get confirmed by the Senate, I would do French in the morning at FSI. Then the afternoon, I would do consultations and studying about my country. So that worked out. Spanish was high school and college, 2 years here at Illinois, because liberal arts and sciences back then, most students had to take 2 years of foreign language. But then when I got the assignment for Maputo, took a crossover course from Spanish into Portuguese for 4 months and got off probation in Portuguese as well. So languages tend to add up over time, but three of those are world languages. They're useful in multiple countries. And in much of Africa, if it's not English, it's French. Portuguese and Arabic would probably be third and fourth on the list. So it turned out to be very handy over time, but we specialize in training in languages. Of course, we recruit officers who already have language skills because they'll come in often with near native or native fluency, which takes a couple of years to develop for most people.
So you mentioned, I should say, we need to take a break in a couple of minutes here, so I'm going to have to interrupt you. But you mentioned you were posted in Sudan next. And I read you were living not far from Osama bin Laden. Of course, you didn't realize it at the time. And I think his name was not as well known, obviously, at the time as it is now. Talk about that.
Okay. This was 1993. My wife was there as the regional personnel officer. I was there as a refugee coordinator. I ran the last resettlement of Ethiopian refugees from Sudan into the United States, and they were sponsored by various charitable and church organizations to resettle them in the United States. So this was a pretty powerful dilemma going on at that time. So we lived in a house near Hassan al-Tarabi. It's a greenhouse, so when you're driving the Jeep, you would look at his greenhouse and track toward it because they were sand. It wasn't paved roads. And there was checkpoints, and you had to show your ID. And you had to have a photography permit issued by the government. So you'd go home, and you had this house, and the kids are there, going to Khartoum American School. Life is good. Others in the embassy. And you would, they were watching us very carefully because of security conditions. So you had a number, and you had a radio, because this is before cell phones. So you'd call it on your radio that you were leaving your residence, and they would keep an eye on you as you went to the embassy, which is in a downtown hotel. We were not told that Osama bin Laden lived there. Of course, this is 1993, so he was not the, he was pre-terrorist at this point. He was a business construction magnate. He was rolling up his millions, which
maybe
later,
this is a good point. We're sort of setting up a cliffhanger here, because I feel like the story is going to get more dynamic at this point, and we need to take a break on the show. We're on a fixed clock. So let me remind listeners, it's the 21st show. We're speaking with Eric Whitaker, former U.S. diplomat. He was ambassador to Niger 2018 to 2021. He is in Central Illinois this week speaking to students at the U of I about careers in the Foreign Service and the Peace Corps, also meeting with people on campus, including at the Center for Africa Studies. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with the retired American ambassador, Eric Whitaker, born and raised in Illinois, schooled at the University of Illinois. He went to the Peace Corps out of college and then eventually joined the United States Foreign Service, where he served in South Korea, Iraq, Sudan, as we were talking about before the break, and ultimately would become the ambassador to Niger, which is a country in the Sahel region of Western Africa. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, before the break, you were talking about life in Sudan. You don't have cell phones. You have to radio your movements when you're going about town and living near. And people might be remember if, you know, if their world history, this is an era in Sudan that would eventually be sort of made famous for American sort of pop culture through the book and movie Black Hawk Down. Happened around this time. If correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but you were saying you would have to radio to your movements around so people could keep an eye on you to ensure your safety.
Oh, absolutely. It was a rugged, what we call hardship post. This is Sudan, at the time, the largest country in Africa. Now, once South Sudan broke off, it no longer held that title. But this is where the Libyan desert is. It's where the Blue Nile comes down from Ethiopia and the White Nile comes up from Uganda. And they go side by side, different speed, different colors, some distance before they merge. It's a fascinating thing to see. Hot as blazes, edge of the desert. And in the north, the Merowe, more pyramids than Egypt. Just phenomenal remote history. It's Nubia from the Bible. It's thousands of years old. Anyways, back to Osama bin Laden. We didn't know he lived there. Of course, he wasn't a, quote, terrorist at that time. And we were relatively junior and wouldn't have what we call need to know We regard the compartmentalization of information, I take that very seriously. We didn't realize that Carlos the Jackal, the international terrorist, also lived there at this time, and we found out later how the French got him. Carlos was very vain. He went into a clinic for liposuction. He woke up a couple of hours later on a French military aircraft en route back to France. Interesting.
Amazing. Wow. Yeah.
So we were evacuated because we moved out of Khartoum in three major steps. We did a very timed drawdown over time. And we have drawdown lists. We take this very importantly. We practice. We very carefully prepare drawdown lists. So we were moved. And what happened was, overnight, we flew down to Nairobi, then up to Addis Ababa. My wife's job was transferred to Addis Ababa, where she was regional, covering Asmara, Addis, Djibouti, Khartoum, and Addis from Addis. I was sent down to Kampala, Uganda, to continue refugee work because it was the same bureau, the same funding. So my work down there was with southern Sudanese who had come across the border fleeing the bombings by the Bashir government. And they were seeking shelter as refugees in northern Uganda, where they were welcome because typically they were the same ethnic groups, Acholi, Bari, Madi, Kakwa, Koko, the same ethnic groups just crossing a somewhat arbitrary line. And in the south of the country, we had second generation Anglophone Rwandan refugees who later on returned with Kagame when they overthrew that government. Then they shipped me up to Zagreb, Croatia for about a half a year to work with Bosnian Muslim resettlement in the United States as the Croats and Serbs basically divided Bosnia-Herzegovina into Croatian Catholic and Serbian Orthodox, and the Muslims were no longer welcome, even though they were all Southern Slavs. They're of a different culture, a different religion. We accepted them, as did many European countries. And these people came to the United States, and they became Americans very quietly, hosted by communities and their churches, probably something you could not do today. Then I had been on the economic commercial officer position in Addis, so I joined my family and worked out perfectly. Then we extended to stay on bidding cycle together. So the family lived in Addis 4 years, and I lived there 3 years. But a wonderful posting, not sub-Saharan Africa, it's Abyssinia. It is that different. We then bid on and competed to go to Bamako, Mali. Rich cultures, just phenomenal country. History, Timbuktu, Muslim, Francophone, Sahelian posting. Adored it. It was just a wonderful place for the kids to grow and for us to do our work. It worked out very well. After that, we bid on and competed to go to Maputo, Mozambique. And that's where we got the 4 months of Portuguese language, which put us off cycle. So we extended to make it a 2.5-year posting to be back on summer cycle, which was when most of our jobs change. And then after Mozambique, we came back to Washington. Foreign service officers need a balance of assignments, not just overseas, even though they're foreign service officers, but also time spent in Washington. And later you realize how important time spent in Washington is, how information moves, how decisions are made, turnover of personnel, 39 bureaus. We're a very large bureaucracy, but you get to learn Hill relations, how to work with Congress effectively. You learn how to work with private business, think tanks, academia, non-governmental organizations, World Bank, IMF, other federal departments. So it's a tremendous experience to come back to Washington. And once you're there, of course, you're Joe Citizen when you walk out the door. You're nobody. You're not as low, you're overseas and you're a diplomat still. So served in Washington. And then they asked us to go back to Washington a little bit later. And we went back to Khartoum. And my wife was management counselor. I was political and economic counselor because we knew the country and they wanted to capitalize on our regional experience. So we went back and the story continued. But in total, it was 12 countries in Africa, 22 years.
All right, I'm going to fast forward a little because I need to be mindful of the time we have together. Let's talk about the Sahel. This is I had a crash course, and I'm going to give our listeners a crash course for those who may not be familiar. Sahel is a word borrowed from Arabic for coast, but it's a metaphor. It's not the ocean coast, but rather the coast between the Sahara Desert and the more humid savannas to the south. This is It really stretches across Africa, but I think geopolitically people refer to a group of countries mostly in Western Africa that includes Senegal, Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad, Nigeria, and Niger, which have similar names after the river in the region, but are very different countries. So you ultimately are appointed ambassador to Niger, Senate confirmed in 2017. You arrive on station December 2017. What are some of the big issues facing you at that time?
Well, very interestingly, I was nominated by President Obama, appointed by President Trump, and I retired under President Biden. It was phenomenal. Niger is the biggest country in West Africa. It bridges between the Maghreb, the countries that are up on the Mediterranean shore, and the coastal West African countries. It's twice the size of Texas, as you pointed out. Mineral wealth, the sun above, solar power, and aquifers below, water, once it can be tapped. It's geostrategically significant in that trade routes, migratory passages go through it. It is exporting oil. Again, you mentioned uranium. It is one of the largest producers in the world. I think it's number 7, but it depends upon the year. But it has an abundance of mineral resources. You said it's about 25 million today, and political turmoil, although it had periods when it was democratic. You know, there's regional competition and ethnic competition for power, and I think that's what took place. Some of the biggest issues are migration and refugees. These are people from central and coastal West Africa coming through Niger en route to Europe. They're channeling up through Agadez, which is the northern regional capital, going across the desert with untold deaths in the desert, then going across the Mediterranean in rubber rafts, untold losses at sea, to get to Europe so one person can work to send money back to support an extended family of 12 to 15 people. Climate change, desertification, deforestation, overgrazing by animals. Now, the population in Africa is increasing faster than any other continent, and Niger has the highest fertility rate in the world. The average woman has 7.2 children. It is just phenomenal. So what do we need to do? Assist Niger in getting more women educated through high school to slow down the population growth rate because the healthcare and education system simply can't keep pace. The population is growing, but the arable land is limited. So it is structurally food deficit. And more people means more animals. More animals means more overgrazing, which means perhaps loss of arable land. It means competition, herder-farmer, for grazing rights and for watering rights. So this sets up conflict. So corridors where the animals are herded seasonally in search of grazing and water are very important in Niger. The minerals, as you mentioned, very important to the economy, but are they getting a fair price for the minerals? Is there corruption involved in payoffs in mining uranium and other products such as gold that are in Niger? And there are probably quite a few others. Agricultural productivity is very limited. It's small shareholder plots, minimal hybrid seed, minimal fertilizer, minimal irrigation. It's a single crop season for most of the country. And it goes Sahara in the north, Sahel across the middle, savanna in the south, as you aptly noted. Well, it's mostly millet and sorghum in the Sahel. The savanna, if you have enough rain, you might have some corn. But as you know, corn is a very rainfall-dependent crop. So it's millet and sorghum, and that's basically what people eat. That's your source of carbohydrates. Other crops they grow, like pigeon peas, cow peas, those they grow, but they're cash crops sold into Nigeria. Cattle are herded into Nigeria by the Fulani, typically. So livestock is a very big part of the economy. So it's agro-based economy. Very little industry, mostly in the capital city and a couple of the other largest cities. Very few expatriates sending remittances home. Very small technocratic class. You go to a ministry and there are 6 people that have a college degree. Very few have a business card. You're aware that the human resource base is quite limited. It's remote. It was francophone. And the French, regrettably, did not invest much in the long-term development of Niger, unlike the coastal countries like Senegal, like Cote d'Ivoire, where Abidjan and Dakar are thriving coastal metropolises. So there's a number of issues for Niger. And I haven't even talked about terrorism.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because it's been described as the global epicenter of terrorism. Now, that's since your ambassadorship. The Global Terrorism Index from the Institute for Economics and Peace says the region, the Sahel, not just Niger, has more than half of the people killed by terrorism in 2024 were killed in that region. There was an American missionary kidnapped from Niamey, spent 6 years in captivity before being released. This is still the so-called Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, which are not words that are every day in the news in America anymore. But can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. Jeffrey Woodkey was kidnapped. He was there working for Eau Vivre, Living Water. He was between Abalak and Tabalak. He was in a fairly remote area in the center of the country. And he was kidnapped. The guard or accompaniment was killed. And again, he was held hostage all those years. Periodically, the terrorist groups, when I was there as deputy many years before, the Salafist group for preaching in combat would come down from Algeria, kidnap a Westerner, hold them for ransom. Fortunately, no Americans were kidnapped during that era. Others were Europeans, Austria, Spain, France, Italy, and so on. And quietly behind the scenes, it appears that ransoms were paid. So the Salafist group gradually made money. And at a certain point, they became an Al-Qaeda franchise. You have to look at terrorism as a business model. They have messaging. They have technologies. They have communications, arms and ammunition, and religious legitimacy, in their eyes. So you have the Al-Qaeda group together with Al-Mudar Batoon, Ansar al-Din, Messina Liberation Front that comprise the JNIM, which is an Arabic acronym. You have that grouping, then you have ISIS, Greater Sahara. Then in the Lake Chad Basin, on the other end of the country, to the east, where Chad, Cameroon, Nigeria, and Niger come together, Boko Haram, forbidden book, Western education is banned. And you also have another ISIS chapter, ISIS West Africa. So you have several terrorist groups at both the western and eastern ends of Niger. And 20,000 people a year have died each of the past 5 years. And I've got graphs to show it, country by country, region by region. 20,000 people a year died due to terrorism. And the governments are hard-pressed to fight this. The terrorists come in on motorcycles, shoot the place up, steal things, and then leave. They don't have a fixed presence. And gradually over time, it's easy to destroy the government's efforts to counter terrorism. You shoot a teacher, you burn a school. It's very easy to downgrade government presence. And the government sometimes is subject to abuses, sometimes, where they come in and say, villagers, you talk to the terrorists, you told them where we were, etc. And they become stuck in the middle. Because whoever's got a gun in their face, they're probably going to have to cooperate because they don't want to be shot. So the civilians are hard-pressed. Now, if you fish, the terrorists might let you fish. You give them 2 out of every 10 fish. You may have to have a permit to farm, and then you give them 10% of your produce. You can mine gold, but you have to give them 1/4 of your gold dust. So the terrorists have found ways to earn money. So they have economic power. They offer services now because the government can't be there anymore because the towns are under siege. And they have religious legitimacy. They come in and say, well, you're not following the religion the proper way. You shouldn't have music. Your clothing should be longer. Your beard should be uncut, for et cetera. So terrorism is taken on. We're not present as we once were, providing intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance.
The military withdrew from Niger last year.
The government of Niger tore up the status of forces agreement and asked that we leave Airbase 101 and Airbase 201, which are Nigerian facilities. So this has had a tremendous downside. We were there and we were assisting them. We were not on the front lines. We were remote, advise, assist, and accompany. Recall that we lost 4 special forces in Tongo Tongo way back in October 2017. We took losses on the ground, and they respect that. We have a memorial on the embassy grounds, which we honor their sacrifice each year. The Nigerians know that we're trying to help them to fight terrorism, but since then, we've been asked out. The French have been asked out. They don't even have an embassy anymore. Yeah. So one of the challenges in West Africa is Russia has come in with disinformation, with troops for hire. It used to be the Prigozhin people.
All right. We're going to have to take a break there. I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but we're on a fixed clock. We will talk about what is happening currently in Niger, as well as the United States government. We're talking with Illinois native and former U.S. Ambassador Eric Whitaker. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with Illinois-born, raised, and educated Eric Whitaker. He went on to have a role in the Peace Corps. He was stationed in the Philippines and then a career in the United States Foreign Service, where he served in Korea and eventually specialized in Africa with postings in Sudan. And he was ambassador to Niger from 2017, formally becomes ambassador early 2018 through 2021. He's been called back into service at least a couple of times since then. If you want to join us today, if you have questions about U.S. foreign policy, particularly as it relates to Africa, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. Ambassador, just about 14 minutes left, and so many things I want to get through in our time together, but we were talking before the break about terrorism in this region, the Sahel region of Africa. What do you understand to be the end goal? Is there, what is the end game, the end goal, if the terrorists, you know, if these groups have their way? What are they trying to do?
They're trying to take over territory and control populations. That's their bailiwick. It's becoming a business that's thriving, recruiting members, paying them salaries, controlling services, making governments look to be weak. It's to gradually win the allegiance of the civilian population. And they're having some success with that. And I don't think the Russian presence, which is now the Africa Corps, is really, in the end, going to help much with this. It's very hard to counter terrorism in a poverty-stricken country because people need water, food, health, and education. It's very hard for government to provide that in remote areas with limited infrastructure.
The Africa Corps, what might be familiar to some listeners as the Wagner Group, is its former name. This was positioned as a sort of mercenary army, although I think that distinction has maybe been erased a little bit over time. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. It has shifted. It was Wagner Associates under Prigozhin, and it was a business model. He was, of course, assassinated, and then the Wagner Associates have gradually phased out, and the Africa Corps has taken over, although they cross-recruited members from Wagner. Now, the Africa Corps is part and parcel government of Russia. It's attached to the Kremlin. So they've peristatalized, I created an English word, peristatalized this mercenary force. So it's now a quasi-governmental entity rather than a Prigozhin private sector entity. But we're getting into really small.
That's interesting. Sort of like quasi-nationalized, I guess.
Exactly.
Yes. Interesting. I want to ask you about a couple of things that happened during your time as ambassador. You are on the ground December 2017. You present your credentials to the president of Niger January 26, 2018, if I have those dates correctly, from the State Department. In between those dates, it's worldwide news that President Trump refers to Africa as having bleep hole countries. This was in the context of a meeting over immigration policy in the United States. I wonder how that came up in the context of your work as a representative of the United States government in Africa.
Well, I think many countries realized early on that the Trump administration, T1, was not overly concerned with Africa. It sent very few people to the continent. It was just not high on their list of priorities. They understood this, but they understood the State Department, USAID, Millennium Challenge Corporation, Department of Defense, that we had strategic interests in Africa and that we wished to partner with them, whether it's emergency humanitarian aid or long-term socioeconomic development. And those things did not change. So they took it, they understood his background as an entertainer, and I think they realized over time that we were actually true partners and we were walking the walk, not just talking the talk. So I think they let that slide.
This, now, in this the seems second, like a, Well, I say this seems like a good time to bring up an email we got from a listener, Isaiah in Rockford, who wants to know if you, as an individual, I guess, ever have ideas about an issue or policies that are different from the official U.S. government position, how you deal with that sort of cognitive dissonance.
One of the fortunate things about working in Africa is what we do has strong bilateral support. Bipartisan support. Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives believe in emergency food aid. Guess what? It comes from the Midwest for the large part. We're feeding people that would otherwise starve. Most people believe in investing in poor countries' health and education systems. Most Americans across the board believe in helping security assistance to help them counter trafficking and criminality and terrorism. Most of us agree to support democratization, market economies, human rights. So a good thing about working in Africa is I never was asked to do something that was against my personal views, my morals, my ethics. And that's a very blessed thing. I am not in the field under T2, although it would be difficult to go in and say, I'm sorry, your country is now under a tariff. I'm sorry, we'd like to ask you if you're willing to accept deportees. I'm sorry, you're on the 90-day visa wait list. Oh, I'm sorry, you're on the travel ban list. I would have a hard time explaining those things to countries in which I could serve. In other words, I retired at a very good time. Last year, I had a recall appointment in Burkina Faso, chargé d'affaires. That was a wonderful experience. I knew the region, the language, the people, the issues. That worked out well. Now in T2, it's a different thing about our relationship with Africa. It's largely about commercial diplomacy. We don't argue against that. We want American businesses to succeed. We want trade with Africa. But the missing part is we've stepped back from development because this administration says that's not America first. Well, a lot of us would argue helping Africa develop means African countries are in a position to buy American goods and services, and that there are stronger economies with fewer people fleeing the country as migrants, that this is a good thing, and maybe there'll be fewer pandemics if people are healthy. I think we have a vested interest in security and stabilization in sub-Saharan Africa. I have not been asked to do something against my personal views. I count myself fortunate.
I wanted to ask you, and you sort of alluded to this, or at least what it was like before. I'm just going to read a social media post, Monday, February 3rd, 2025, 12:54 a.m. Illinois time. Quote, "We spent the weekend feeding USAID into the wood chipper, could gone to some great parties, did that instead." End quote. Verbatim. That is, of course, Elon Musk. What did you think? What do you think of what has happened to USAID and American foreign aid?
It's a tragedy. It's actions being taken by people who dance on a stage with a chainsaw who somehow think this is serving the taxpayer and the citizens of America. It's not. We're looked to for strength, not just material and financial strength, but moral virtue strength as well. People count on USAID to help them with health systems, education systems, agricultural productivity, a number of things. They're expert at what they do. They have language abilities, regional skills. They know how to build up ministries, how to work through parastatals and non-governmental organizations, how to coordinate their efforts with those of other countries, with the World Bank, to help countries develop. It's a shame that people think that it's not in keeping with our values, because it is who we are as a people. Too much is given, much is expected. And I think you know where that comes from. It's a shame that we're cutting back. Other countries look to us to be an exemplar. My buds at an embassy are Western ambassadors, like-minded ambassadors, the World Bank, the large Save the Children, World Vision, CARE, the large NGOs. These are our partners. They count on us to set an example and put our money where our mouth is. We're stepping back from that role, and that's really a shame, and we can't defend it. And we're talking about a fraction of 1% of our budget. It's not as though we're achieving substantial cost savings by doing so. And these programs are all audited. There's nothing corrupt about them.
Something that seems to be uniting people on both the right and the left, or I guess, you know, the pretty hard left in America, is this idea of withdrawing from the world, withdrawing from the global stage. American can sort of turtle into itself. And you know, we've talked about the rising terrorist threat in Western Africa. It sort of puts me in mind of America in the 1990s, where there were a lot of things happening overseas that, Americans were happy to kind of not think too hard about until, to borrow a famous phrase, the chickens came home to roost in 2021. I wonder how you think about that and what case you would make to, Americans, to everyday Americans, that they should be more engaged, we should be more engaged in this very remote to us part of Africa.
Okay. Previous Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said, America is the indispensable nation. We're needed. We're counted on by others. There's things that we uniquely can do. Becoming neo-isolationist doesn't make America stronger. It's receding from alliances. NATO has worked for decades, worked very well. World Bank, IMF programs have worked for decades. The NGOs we support, our alliance, our work with like-minded embassies and their aid agencies, we're accomplishing something jointly. We need these alliances. It's through these alliances that we have strength. We need our partners, and our partners need us. So stepping back from that is receding from a position where we can steer the ship of the global system. Why should we stop doing that? Believe you me, China is promoting its candidates to hold office in international organizations. Why? They want to rejigger the architecture of the international system. That's the Bretton Woods institutions, the rules of the game. We have a vested interest in continuing to shape them so that things go along on a predictable, stable path. Otherwise, we leave the world to the Chinas, the Russias, and the other competitors. We have a role to play, and stepping back from it does not make us stronger.
I wonder if your colleagues, if you hear from colleagues in the Foreign Service still, who is it harder to do the sort of detail work like, you know, emergency logistical support? You mentioned jail visits. I heard from someone who had a friend, this is some years ago, but they were about to be sent to a gay conversion camp in an African country. I'm keeping the details vague intentionally here to protect that person, but they got significant help from the embassy. Given everything that's happened with the government this year, are those resources still as strong as they were in the past?
It's difficult to say because I finished work June 30 of last year. So I've been out of the system for, a year and 4 months now. So I and my friends, and there's a group of us that has lunch every 2 months. There's another group, and we have Washington Capitals hockey tickets, season tickets together. We continue to touch base with each other. But again, we're on the outside looking in. How is our department changing? Of course, I'm a boomer. Many of my cohorts have gradually retired. We're not sure what's being left behind resembles the Foreign Service of our heyday. We think over time it is less and less doing so. It's changing, but I'm not out in an embassy where USAID is gone. Millennium Challenge Corporation has left. We have vacancies in many of our Afghan posts. Most of them were very hard to staff as it stood. So we fear that a lot of things we did simply aren't happening any longer. And the excuse that's always given is, that's not America first, whatever that's supposed to mean. And this is people who are not looking long-term what is truly in our interests, and that being strong means being capable of helping others, and that others be stable is a good thing for the global system, including for us. So things are happening. We don't know.
Yeah, just a minute and a half or so left. As we're speaking, it's October 2025. You're going to be speaking with students through the Career Center at the University of Illinois this week about the Peace Corps and the Foreign Service. Would you recommend a young person consider a career in the Foreign Service, given what we've been talking about with the American government's actions with regard to foreign policy, as well as just how we've seen government employees treated this
year
in general?
Yes, yeah. I do, because when we were under T1, Linda Thomas Greenfield, our assistant secretary, my boss, asked us, Africa Hands, we need you to stay on for the rebuild after this administration. And we did. And I reminded her that we kept this promise. I imagine somewhere she or others are saying, we need you to stay on after T2 to rebuild the State Department, perhaps to reopen USAID or at least continue its functions. So, yes, I think that's out there. And when I talk to kids in master's programs, because I work with a couple of other alma maters, I say to them, okay, down the road, there's going to be opportunities. Finish your master's, volunteer, gain experience, travel abroad, gain generic managerial skills, including written and verbal communication skills, and read Time, New York Times and The Economist. Stay current on events. There will be a time down the road when the Foreign Service will bring in more candidates, and we need people who are well prepared for it. Oh, and also world language. Get a world language. And this will prepare you for the future.
Eric Whitaker, born and raised in Illinois, ultimately the United States ambassador to Niger. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st Show. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Brian. I enjoyed it as well.
That's all the time for us today. We love hearing from you about what we talked about on our program. Send us an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address. You can find that and every other way to contact us on our website, 21stshow.org. Coming up tomorrow on the program, the language we use every day evolves slowly over time. But the linguist Adam Alexic, known online as the Etymology Nerd, says the rise of the internet and short-form video is accelerating that effect. All this is the subject of his new book, Algo Speak. It's coming up tomorrow here on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.